So I just met Michael a little bit ago. I know he comes from the Fifth Tradition Group, and we ended up sharing a lot of guys with him, or a lot of speakers from there. And we really appreciate that he came on down to speak with us tonight. With that, I give you Michael.
All right. I'm Michael Hart. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Hi, everybody. My sobriety date is August 23rd of 87. That can be a booby trap. You can get some time and come in here and sit and say, well, I'm supposed to have this much time, so I'm not supposed to really be going through this. Or they're not really going to understand this. Or they're going to judge me because so-and-so. So time can be a booby trap. The pretty neat thing about having a little bit of time is you've got a track record of when you do the right thing, and you've got a track record of when you do the wrong thing. And you got better choices. Those red flags, you stop ignoring them. For a long time, red flags would happen, and I'd paint the bastards green. And I'd go ahead and march through it. I'm a native of Georgia. I guess you think some of this twang comes from Georgia, but I was actually raised by a hillbilly. Yeah, it's funny. I was born in the doctor's hospital in Tucker, Georgia in 64. My real father worked at the Scottsdale Mill. My grandfather worked at the Scottsdale Mill. And we was poor, but didn't know we was poor. My father was an alcoholic. Him and my mother divorced when I was four. Didn't really know much about him. What I do remember is that one day my sister said he cares more about the bottle than he does us. I've got an older sister by my mom's first marriage, me and my sister. The man was a very angry person, very high-strung, very intense, and that's about all I remember of him. My mother and him divorced when I was four, and another man came into my life. And usually when I talk about this man was my father because he's the one who raised me. He was from West Virginia, or actually Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, coal mine country, hillbillies. And the Schraders from up there, they were really hard people. He was baby of 14. He got one pair of shoes a year, and that was school time. They worked the farm barefooted. And the Schraders was the Hatfields and McCoys. And that was the way I was taught. You know, I was the ideas I grew up with was mean. The Schraders tried to kill each other. If they didn't know you, they didn't want to know you. My stepdad's mother lived with us after she got older, and she quilted, made big quilts, and I'd sit at the quilt with her, and she taught me how to sew and told me some incredible stories of the early 1900s in the mountains of Bluefield. That woman was sweet, but she was mean. I've got a younger brother by my mom's second marriage. He's 4 years younger than me. My sister's 4 years older, and I was in the middle. And I was the problem child. But I remember that little old woman. I don't remember what my brother did, but she was going through the house beating him with a cane. My brother was trying to get away from her, and he was about 6 years old at the time. And he pulled a chair in between her and him, and she was in her late 80s at the time, and she rolled over that chair and got up and never missed a beat, beating the shit out of him. And so that's the type of family I came from. They were hillbillies. My southern twang came from them. I sometimes think I've lost it, but I haven't. I get reminded very quickly from the people here from the north. I used to hate it, but I learned to embrace it. I used to hate it that I was raised by a hillbilly, but I learned to embrace that too. like I shared, my stepfather was, I guess you could say he was redneck, if that's what you want to call it. He had that implanted redneck syndrome, and he was alcoholic. And when I was 11 years old, or I'm sorry, when I was 10 years old, my real father died. And he died January 28th, and they buried him February 1st, which is my birthday. So for a 10-year-old boy, that was pretty hard. That brought up a lot of abandonment issues. I'm the only one in the family that turned out to be an alcoholic. My sister isn't. My brother isn't. Really fairly highly intelligent people. My sister's the only person I've ever known that has one job. She still has that same job that she had when she got when she was 16, and she's 56 now. my cousin never made below an A in high school. Made a lot of awards, but she can't shave her own legs. No common sense at all. My brother has a photographic memory. And then we had me that had learning disabilities. Back when I was in high school, they called it hyperactive. They didn't have ADHD label on it. And they didn't know what to do with us, so they set us in a room and we looked at each other. And they wanted to put me on lithium, and my mother said no. Actually, my mother said hell no. And I think that was one of the best things that my mother did for me. I realized, you know, back then I thought I was stupid. My sister used to tell me I was retarded and had me believing it. She convinced me that it was on my birth certificate. But I couldn't speak good. I had a speech therapist. I didn't really start speaking until I was 6 years old, but I just didn't know how to talk. A lot of emotional things went on at home, and I see now why I didn't talk. A lot of violence with my stepfather. When my stepfather drank, him and his buddies would get together on Friday night and play the guitar. My stepfather sounded better than Waylon Jennings. I don't know why he never did anything with it. But my first drink of alcohol was Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. And he would, after everybody goes home, he would tear up the house. One night he shot up the house. When I was 13, he took a claws of hammer to his brother, tried to kill his brother. DeKalb County surrounded our house. And back then, things was a little different. I still got the picture. I got the mug shot. The only picture I have of my stepfather and my mother, DeKalb County, let him go back in the back of the jail, and they took pictures of both of them. It was a mug shot, and I blew it up and framed it. That's the only picture I have on it, of him, you know, but it was kind of funny. Back then, things was a little different. But he put alcohol down himself. So, you know, when I had a drinking problem, they thought I was supposed to put it down also. Did really good in school at first. When I got into 8th and 9th grade, I was athletic, but suddenly I started having some problems. I couldn't run like I was supposed to. And mother took me to the doctor, and they found out that I had a disease called ankylosing spondylitis. And what that is a form of rheumatoid arthritis, and it's in the spine, and your spine fuses to be one bone. And this was when I was 12, and it was crippling me pretty fast. They told me if I didn't do the physical therapy the way I was supposed to and take my medicine the way I was supposed to, that I was going to be in a wheelchair by the time I was 16. And at first I wouldn't do what she told me to do. Donna Gibbous Emery was my doctor, and she showed me a little boy that was paralyzed and with the same disease, and it scared me. And so from 12 to 15, I spent a lot of time at the Crippled Children Clinic, a lot of time at Grady Memorial because we didn't have much money, a lot of intense pain with it. My knees would swell up where I couldn't get them over my jeans. My mother would have to cut my jeans. And missed a lot of school at that time. got behind in school. Kids can kind of be mean to kids. It's different, and I was different. I didn't really fit in. I hung out in the smoking area with the freaks, and I didn't smoke. I played sports with the jocks, and because I had some athletic disabilities, I didn't fit in there. Because the way Mama would make me dress, I dressed like the preppies, and I sure in hell didn't fit in there. So I didn't feel like I really belonged. And back then, the only thing they had for inflammation was aspirin. They didn't have any other drugs back then that help inflammation. And the inflammation in my spine was pretty intense. So they, by the time I was 14, they had me on 25 aspirin a day. 5 in the morning, 5 at lunch, 5 at dinner, and 5 at bedtime. So I got used to doing this. And by the time I was 15, it had burned a hole in my stomach. And I had a Grady card because we didn't have much money, so Mama would get us big old box of Maalox with these brown bottles about this big. And I had to drink one in the morning and one at night. So I got used to doing this. So when I did get back to school, because I was ADHD, if that's what you want to call it, I spent a lot of time in the hall and met this boy that had missed some school, and he was a couple years older than me. And he could drink 10 ounce beers in a minute and won money doing it and taught me how to do it. So I got used to inhaling beer. And, you know, I don't really want to talk much about my war stories. We all got them. You know, I'm supposed to share what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Y'all pretty much know what happened from that point on. You know, suddenly I didn't give a damn that I didn't fit in, because something magical happened when I put alcohol in me. Already had doing this. So around 17 or so, I was introduced to Quaaludes. Thank God they quit making them, because I wouldn't be here today. But right before I started drinking, though, I had went into depression. And a lot of times here in AA, we don't talk much about depression, but a lot of us have it. And if it wasn't for alcohol, my depression would have killed me. Because I couldn't understand that why there wasn't a God. Because at the Crippled Children Clinic, I seen a lot of sick children. I seen a lot of crippled children. And I would tell my mama, "See, I'm not that bad, Mama, look." And I didn't believe that there was a God. And Mama couldn't get me to leave my bedroom sometimes. And she'd say, "Just come in here and talk to me." And I wouldn't leave the bedroom. And it was depression. So something magically happened when I was taught how to throw down Budweiser. And I took the ball with it and ran for 8 years. And in that 8 years, I drank hard for 8 years. In that 8 years, I had 11 public drunks, 9 disorderlies, a hit and run, surgery on my eyes to do the fights, and 6 DUIs. So I earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. But what I do want to talk about, one war story that really, see, I get to stand up here and talk to y'all. I get to work these steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My hit and run, the two individuals that was in my apartment that night, will always be in my heart. Cindy Spradlin and Shane Taft. Both of those individuals said that they were too drunk to go anywhere, and I said, "Fuck it, I'll go." And left and was shit-faced and hit some cars leaving my apartment over there on Shalifer Road. Ran from the police on foot and helicopter. Got away from them. But those two individuals, Cindy Spradlin later OD'd on heroin and swallowed her puke, and that's what killed her. Shane Taft hit a pickup truck on his motorcycle drunk. They're not here today, but I am, and I was the reckless one. I get to be here. I get a second chance. And it took me years in recovery to realize that I get a second chance to live. And the pretty neat thing, I've learned the hard way, that I don't only get a second chance to live, But this second chance to live is not mine. I'm supposed to serve God. You know, God is either everything or he is nothing. You know, and for the first decade in program, I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that God was everything or he was nothing. And, you know, my ego had to be punctured several times, actually more than several times, because my ego would say, I got this. I can do this. You know, I'm sure y'all have heard anything that you put before your recovery, you'll lose. Well, my ego didn't believe that. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had that gift of desperation. And I had a real good paying job. I worked at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution in the 80s. And started there when I was 19. When I was 21, 22, I was making $14 an hour there. And back then, that was really, really good money. And everybody there drank like I did. All my friends around me drank like I did. I surrounded myself around people that drank like I did. Had good work ethics that my stepfather had taught me. But suddenly I couldn't get to work anymore. And my boss sent me home. I had lost my license on that hit and run. So I moved closer to work, you know, and kept drinking. And went to court on that hit and run. And the guy sitting next to me has shackles on his ankles and handcuffs on his wrist. And when they called my name, they called witness out for a few minutes. And he leaned over to me and he said, God, I'm glad I'm not you. And he had shackles on his ankles. And I got my license suspended. That was the only thing I got in trouble for. So I got that truck fixed. And hadn't had that truck back 10 days and slammed it in the guardrail at Shamley Tucker and 85 North. So I moved closer to work. My denial of what was going on was really high. So when my boss sent me home, I knew I was getting ready to lose my job. And I said out loud, if there is a God, please help me. And 15 minutes later, I dialed the information to Peachford. And got the telephone number, and I got somebody on the telephone, and they said, well, just be still. We'll get somebody to you tomorrow. Well, by the next day, I had already changed my mind. But I went anyway. And they put me in treatment over in Buford. I went through a 28-day treatment center. And then went back home to my apartment and went back to my job. But I had that gift of desperation. And I rode a bicycle everywhere. And the condos that was next to my apartment is where I met my sponsor. I met him at Tucker, St. Andrews was my original home group. But he would take me to the Biscayne Room. And Ron LaJoy was his name. He had one arm. And he said, you're going to clean ashtrays. And I said, I don't smoke. And he said, I don't give a damn. And so I stood at the sink in the back of the Biscayne Room, and I'd wash those ashtrays. And I'd have to interact with people. And I hated people. I didn't want to interact with people. You know, and he told me I was going to stand at the front door and welcome people. And I said, what does this got to do with staying sober? And he said, don't worry about it. And, man, I hated him. And I made a mistake one day. I called him, and I said, I'm bored. And he said, no, you're boring. Get a fucking hobby. And I didn't know what a hobby was. I had to look the word up. Because, see, what I thought was fun was distorted. I mean, you know, when I was blacked out or I went to the mirror and my eyes was black or I woke up with my clothes on, I must have had fun, you know. So I didn't know what fun was. I was really involved. Music's always been a big part of my life. And I had went to many concerts blacked out, lost my concert t-shirts, not even remember how in hell I got home. So I went back and seen all of them again, every one of them, plus some. And the amazing thing is the next morning I still had my concert t-shirts, you know. And I've always, I'm in the car business now, but I've always been fascinated with cars. So into my second year in recovery, I got a 65 Fastback Mustang, and I restored it. And kept the car for 19 years, but that was one of my first hobbies. And real quick, I want to read something, because, you know, in my first 2 years, I thought I could work the steps and move on, and I would be fine. You know, I could go. Somehow, somewhere in my mind, I thought that I would not have to do this all my life. And I didn't want to do this all my life. You know, I had mentioned that my stepfather had put it down, and my family thought I was supposed to be able to, too. That I was supposed to be strong enough to put it down. But he became a stark, raving, sober lunatic, and I hated him in my teens. So I did not want to be that, but I didn't think that I was going to have to go to AA for the rest of my life. And in the Keys of the Kingdom, second to last paragraph on the chapter, it says, AA is not a plan of recovery that can be finished and done with. It is a way of life, and the challenges contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives. We do not, cannot outgrow this plan. As the rest alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows for limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other is essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in a retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogressive can spell death for us. However, this isn't as rough as it sounds. As we do become grateful for the necessity that makes us toe the line, for we find that we are more than compensated for a constant effort for the countless divines we receive. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from our responsibilities, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape some perplexed problem, we experience the thrill of challenge and the opportunity it affords for another application of AA techniques, and we find that ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. And I had to look up the word vigor, and what it means is health and strength. And that whole paragraph describes my life in recovery. You know, growing up, my father used to say, boy, you're irresponsible as hell. And I was, you know. I mean, if it came to buying a 12-pack or paying my gas bill, or buying a 12 or buying an 8-ball instead of paying my rent, guess what I did? You know? So being responsible was not something that I was. And learning to be that, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I got here, I thought my life was over with. Little did I know, it was just beginning. And the excitements that was getting ready to happen, good and bad. You know, if you're new in here, and when I say new, I mean under 5 years, buckle up and hold on. Some pretty neat things is going to happen. Some pretty interesting things is going to happen. Into my second year, I told y'all I had got that Mustang and started restoring it. you know, I was told not to get in a relationship in my first year, and I didn't listen. Everything I did drunk, I had to do sober before I learned from it. A number of them I had to do more than once, especially if it felt good. I was going to do it more than once. I was right out of treatment, and a lady that I met at the treatment center had 2 years. Her and I got involved. About 6 months into recovery, she decided she didn't want me anymore, and it was pretty painful. And got in a fight with my brother, broke my wrist. So into my first year, I had that cask on my arm, and I told y'all my sponsor didn't have one arm, and he'd make me put together dances with him at the Biscayne Room, and he had no pity on me at all. You know, I'd say, I can't this, I can't. He said, horse shit. Get over there and do that. But he was teaching me how to do service work. You know, he'd put together dinners at his house, and he'd make me come over and help him cook, and I didn't want to. I was like, what the hell has this got to do with staying sober? He'd say, don't worry about it. So, you know, into my second year in sobriety, into my third year in sobriety, I met my son's mother. And I got her pregnant. And my mama and my best friend's dad told me that I had to marry her. And I was wanting to be responsible, so I married her. You know, thought that was what I was supposed to do. My best friend, I was 2 years in the program, and he killed someone in another car. And that was the path that I was on. I chose to get off of it before him. And his first 6 months in the program, I took him to a meeting every night. He got sentenced 15 years. He served four of it. I prayed to God every night to bring him into the program, but he didn't bring him in the way I wanted him to. You know, and I had a problem with God early on in recovery because God didn't act like I wanted him to. You know, and I married my son's mother, and she didn't really understand Alcoholics Anonymous, and I slowly let her pull me away. So I became that stark raving sober lunatic that my stepfather was. And I had to experience that. Because at that time, I realized I was acting just like my stepfather. And when I walked through it and got to the other side of it, I forgived him. You know, and early on, I had put conditions on my sobriety. You know, things that would happen that would take me back out. Well, I sit here today and every one of them has passed. And I never once thought about a drink or a drug when I was going through them. You know, I had that son. and being a father is one of the most rewarding things that I've ever got to experience. I can't describe the love. If this place was on fire and he was in the corner in there somewhere, I'd get him. That's just the way it is. He's 26 years old now. November he'll be 27. He's never seen me drunk. And that was a spiritual blessing that, you know, early on I would have made that list of things that I thought I wanted. And I'd been really cutting myself way too short. Because it would have all been material things. You know, the first 10 years in the program, I really had my head up my ass. You know, we have a disease of alcoholism. And I hear people say their disease is out there in the parking lot doing push-ups. No, mine's in my head. It's living and it's well. I mean, I sit here for almost three decades, and I tell you, at times I've had people shake their head at me and go, "You keep coming back." You know, because I've been crazy, and I've had times where people just parted and got the hell out of my way. You know, especially that 5 to 9 years, because I was really raging at that time. Because I don't know about some of the men in here, but usually the first emotion I feel is anger, and it comes from the Hatfields and McCoys that I grew up with. You know, because that's one of the old ideas. You know, it was second decade in this program that I heard for the first time, the results is nil until you let go absolutely. I didn't know what the hell that meant. You know, and when I let go of something, then God takes it. And, you know, I was talking about my son and his mother. I asked her for a divorce when I was 6 years sober, and she disappeared with my son. I couldn't find her. And he was the first grandbaby, and my mama didn't cut me any slack. My mom was close to my son, and she would look at me in tears and say, "He's gone, and it's your fault." And took me a year to find her. She had went to Florida, and finally got my divorce. And she manipulated the system and wanted it. I was living in Clayton County, and she was trying to get it back in the system. And I was paying child support pretty regular. Thank God I kept my paperwork and my checks, stubs, and my canceled checks. Clayton County came and locked me up with my son in my custody. He was asleep when they come and got me. And I spent 30 days in jail in Clayton County with no bond. Jerry Benefield was my sponsor at the time. Thank God for Jerry and Mary Benefield. A friend of mine, Sue, was babysitting my son or keeping my son while I was in jail. And I was in the holding cell before they had put me into wherever they had put me. my son bawling, crying, saying, Daddy, where are you? Daddy, why can't you come get me? Daddy, please come get me. And I'm sitting in jail with no bond. And it was a pretty hard time. You know, I was 6-7 years into recovery. And I'd sit there saying, this ain't supposed to be happening to me. I'm sober. But it did happen to me. And I was able to walk through that and stay sober. My son never heard me say anything bad about his mother. And fast forward, when he was 13, he said he wanted to come live with me. And we were in Florida, and I said, well, you know, I'm harder on you than your mama is. And when you make that decision, it's not going to be a decision that you make. You're not going to go back and forth. When you make that decision, you're going to make that decision. You also got to realize what it's going to do to your mama when you do make that decision. Well, it took another year or so, and then he made that decision and come and I finished raising him. I was married a second time. I was married to a woman in South America, from South America, from Ecuador. Very exotic woman. It was one of those, you know, I'm an alcoholic man. And I don't know if any other men can relate to this, but I can have a trophy on my arm and look at the woman across the room that's not so pretty and wonder what it'd be like to be with her. You know, I want more romance. I want more of everything. I'm never satisfied. That's part of my alcoholism. Catalina was strong Catholic. I was married to her for 5 years. Went to Ecuador and climbed the highest active volcano in the world, Cotopaxi. Took my son over there with me the second time I went over there, and we straddled the equator together. It was pretty neat. My stepfather in 99 was diagnosed with lung cancer. And we were able to sit down, and he had nothing he was upset at me about except my relationships with women. And there was so much he could have been upset at me about. And the way that man taught me how to live, and that man also taught me how to die. He died January 3rd of 2000. And as a little boy, I had always wanted a tow truck because I always loved cars. Well, about 90 days after he died, I signed on my first tow truck. I actually got it with a bad check. And they held the check until I got the money in the bank. And that was in 2000. By 2004, I had 4 tow trucks and 11 employees. And what I was telling you all ago, anything you put in front of your recovery, you will lose. Or anything you put in front of God, you will lose. That is exactly what I did. I made crazy money. I worked around the clock. There's not an exotic car that I have not had in my possession. And I worked everybody to death that worked for me. I burned everybody out. And I was a asshole. One of the dealers I used to work for knew I was in the program. And he said, man, I couldn't imagine you drunk. You're asshole sober. And I was. But I put all of that before God. And in 2005, I had a drunk driver hit one of my tow trucks in Charlotte. Interesting how that happened, how many times I drove drunk. But Nationwide was their insurance, and they didn't want to pay me immediately, and it actually put me on radar with DOT. And there were some regulations that I wasn't compliant with, and they shut me down. In 2006, I went through a DOT audit. I had police officers sitting at my breakfast table going through my paperwork. And I had to let those 11 people go. And I bankrupted the business. By then, I was into my third relationship with another woman that became my best friend. I had divorced Kathy. It was a pretty peaceful divorce. We actually did it at the UPS store, signed the papers. The guy at the UPS store must have thought we was fucking crazy because we were just, you know, okay with each other. But I met this other girl named Gina Ford, and she helped me finish raising my son. She was a Southern girl, and she became my best friend. And, you know, I told y'all about some of the conditions I had put on my sobriety, but this was a condition that I never thought, I never dreamed that would happen. You know, she stuck with me through the stuff of my bankruptcy, and she was there with me when DOT went through my paperwork and shut me down and fined me $10,000. And I was like, this ain't supposed to be happening to me. I'm sober. I was afraid I was going to lose my home that I bought. And that Mustang that I had restored, talking about responsibility, and this talks about how we shoulder it. By that time, I had that Mustang for 19 years, and I had to make a choice, save the house or sell the Mustang. And I sold the Mustang to save the house. I can't live in the Mustang. And so that's what I did. And I got one tow truck and started over again by myself and stayed under the radar with regulations with DOT. And not long ago, I downsized again. I'm still self-employed. I've been self-employed. I don't think I'm employable by anyone else. I mean, I think I'm just one of them alcoholics. It's just, you know, I went to a dually and a 19-foot trailer, and I still work for the dealerships. I work for Lexus right now, and I still get to play with cars. You know, I still get to do that little boy's dream. But that girl that I was telling you about that was my best friend, and end of 2010, it had just kind of flowed that way. She just wanted me. She didn't care how she got me. She didn't care if I ever married her. She didn't care. She just wanted to be with me. And I put a ring on her finger December of 2010. March of 2011, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and 10 days later, she was diagnosed with bone cancer. And my mother had died in 2009, and Gina was there with me and helped me through that. And when my mama died, I thought that was just, you know, I said to Gina that night, I said, now I'm going to have to grow up. You know, mama called me when she was having her heart attack, me trying to get her to call 911, and she wouldn't. And the last words my mother said to me was, hush your mouth. I still haven't learned how. But the night before, me and Gina had dinner with my mother. And that's one of them spiritual blessings that you don't know that you're having as it's happening. My mama's last dinner on this earth was with me. And out of the siblings, the last phone call was to me. So, you know, I thought that would just be, that's enough. Pretty neat thing, I sat here today, Gina passed away 2014, October. And I'm the last man that she ever loved. And that's another spiritual blessing that I never thought I would receive. And it didn't feel like a blessing walking through it. You know, she was diagnosed with cancer. And in the first year, her sister and her mother would take her to chemo. And she'd come in and come back and go downstairs and pass out. And me and my son would beg her to eat. She'd finally get her appetite back. She'd finally get some energy to go upstairs. And right as she'd get her energy back, it was time to go to do chemo again. And, you know, people would ask me, how you doing? Oh, I'm fine. I'm okay. But really, I wasn't, because slowly it was wearing me out. And into the second year of her cancer, we both became different people. Between the steroids that they had in her chemo bag so she wouldn't get nauseous, and them taking her ovaries because of cancer feeding off of it, sending her into menopause, and the Oxycontin for the bone cancer, she became a violent person. And it was hard to live with. I didn't really realize how much my son helped me until the Navy put him over in Britain, and then I was doing it by myself. And it really wore me out. And Gina and I separated. And she left me a letter as she was leaving, and she said, first of all, I want to say I love you, but my cancer's taken a toll on both of us. And it had. It had whipped my ass. I don't wish that on my worst enemy. So for 10 months, she would go away and come back and go away and come back. And I would let her. And then I did what I do. I band-aided it with another woman. And led this woman to believe that I would marry her. And guys, you know, after being married twice, you know, you get to take inventories over the year. You pretty much learn stuff about yourselves. You know, I'm a good man. I'm a bad boy. But I'm a good friend. And I'm a good boyfriend. But I am not a husband. And I'd let this woman and her daughter move into my house. In August of 2014, Gina decided not to do treatment anymore. And at the same time, this woman asked me to set a wedding date. And I was like, You know, marriage just scares the shit out of me. It just does. And pissed her off. And I realized, you know, the book says selfishness and self-centeredness to be the root of our problems. You know, it says we must get rid of it or it kills us. Pretty strong words. Must get rid of it or it kills us. Well, see, my selfishness and self-centeredness, up to that point, I'd got away with a lot of things. You know, in here where it says we toe the line, well, throughout the years, God's kept me on a short leash and a shorter leash and a shorter leash. And I don't get away with nothing that I used to get away with. And that's okay, because with divine help, I got some amazing things that happened in my life. But my selfishness, October of 2014, Gina passed away. And 20 minutes before she died, she told her sponsor to tell me first that she did not want me to find out through Facebook or through announcements in AA, because she knew I still loved her, even though she knew I was with another woman. And when she passed away, her family asked me to leave the funeral. They blamed me for her having cancer and for me being with another woman. And I hurt them. My selfishness hurt a lot of people. And at that point, I realized how bad my selfishness had hurt a lot of people. And you know, I don't have any excuse for it except not to be as selfish. You know, I decided for 2 years that I wouldn't have anything to do with any women. And I started going to the fifth tradition, and I'd sit there. Nobody knew who I was because I would just sit there and be quiet. He'd speak to me every now and then. But I'd sat there with another friend of mine, and I hid at fifth tradition. And I did. You know, I'm the type of alcoholic, I can alienate myself in a room full of people. And I've watched people with double digits do the same thing and what happens to them. A friend of mine, Chris Benitti, had 18 years in the program. A couple of years ago at Triangle, I had just bought my dually out here, and he was excited out there on a Thursday telling me what I ought to do and how I should do this and how that. Never had a clue. The next morning, he shaved his hair off and got in the tub and blew his head off. See, guys, we deal with another thing that people don't talk about in here. We deal with depression. And if we don't talk to other people about it, it kills us. Because see, that the depression is where the self-centeredness comes in. And the book says we must get rid of that selfishness or it kills us. It doesn't say how it's going to kill us. It says it kills us. Sometimes I hate people. But I got to have y'all. It's a necessity. There's a reason why that first word starts with we and that first tradition starts with our. Because our common welfare comes first. And what I've learned in the last year is to put myself on the other side of the table in the other person's seat. Because if you've been around as long as I have, you've got some people that love you and you got some people that hate you. It's just the way it is. If you like everybody, you ain't been enough AA meetings. If you like everybody, you ain't really hit a bottom yet. Because when my irritable, restless, and discontent comes out, I don't like none of you. And I'll be sitting in the room, and I say, God, here she goes again. The same shit. You know? And my mind, man, I'll be thinking some crazy shit and sit down and listen to you and say, oh, I'm all right. You know? Because I have a disease of alcoholism. You know, and I've spent a lifetime seeking vengeance. Thank God it never found me. I also realized this past year that all my misery derives from not being able to sit in a room alone with God. When I'm able to do that, some amazing things happen. And I can watch other people, and I see other people seek for happiness in the distance or seek it through money, property, prestige, because I did, because I can see it now. Or I see people create it under their feet. And I like to think I'm one that creates it under my feet because I've learned to do certain things, and it's necessity. I will seek out where the homeless is, and I will go help them at the holidays. A couple of years ago, I went through a spiritual retreat in Delonico. And the reverend that spoke there just happened to be from Bluefield, Virginia, where my stepfather was from. And he's the head pastor and created a place called City of Refuge. So I went up to him afterwards and I asked him, hey, can I help you collect toys for the children? And he said, yeah. So a couple of years ago, I started putting boxes at the Biscayne Room at the Triangle. The year before, they had 157 children. We made sure they had Christmas. City of Refuge is for women that was involved in trafficking. And what they do there is they teach them a trade so they don't have to go back to it. And they also have their children there. Last year, they had 267 children there, and we made sure 267 children had Christmas. I learn when I give back, I get tenfold back. But see, if I'm being selfish and self-centered, I can't see that. When I'm all about me, I can't see. But amazing things happen when I open my eyes. You know, I've got a sponsor that's got a sponsor. You know, my sponsor's got 42 years, Robert Kennedy. And he has a book study at his house right now. We're going back through the steps. I have to do that. I have to keep it fresh. I know some of y'all heard farther down the path, the narrower the path gets. Well, it does. I feel today I have to do more today than I did early on. I can't get away with the stuff I used to because I know more. I know by trial and error because I've tried to get away with it because my ego say, oh, I got this. You know, I've learned to turn my will and my life over with majority of the stuff in my life, but not my romances and finances. I still try to take control of those and fuck them up every time. And then ask God, you know. And my son, it's kind of funny one day. I know y'all read the chapter with the jaywalker. Well, see, that's my life. I will do that with other things. It's going to be different this time. Or she's prettier. My son, he's... One day, a year ago, he said, Daddy, and he was talking about women. He said, Daddy, you get on a horse, it knocks you off. You get on a horse second time, it knocks you off. The third time, you stay the fuck off the horse, Daddy. And I said, Spencer, I'm just not wired that way. You know. And I have to realize I am wired differently. I think differently. My ego it's all about me. My selfishness and self-centeredness. I mean, I know y'all not thinking about me because you're thinking about yourself, you know. But I'll walk in a room thinking everybody's thinking about me. Or something will happen and I'll think it's all about me. And it really isn't. You know, right now my sponsor's having me read the 7th step and the 12 and 12 every day. And I went to him the other day and I said, you know, so-and-so's in here. Man, I didn't. He said, it's been there all along, Michael. And reality of it is, when the student's ready, the teacher appears. But the student's got to be ready. You know, life's really easy with eyes closed, misunderstanding all that I see. But once my eyes is open, I have to change the behavior. And that's what happens in the 7th step. With me, it's always taking pain. But I'm finding out that I can have humility without the pain. I can see it coming and be a little humble about it. And that's took 3 decades to learn this. You know, because I'm hard-headed. I still want the old ideas to work. And the old ideas don't work anymore. And the result is nil until I let go absolutely. And I will try my hardest to put the square peg in the round hole and figure out a way why it should go. And, you know, it goes on to say in that chapter 2 about the self-centered fear and the self-illusions. Well, those self-illusions. I've learned if I'm the smartest person in the room, it's time to go to another meeting. Because I can't be the smartest person in the room. You know, I need to bounce things off of people that's been ahead of me. Because I'll think something a certain way and I'll bounce it off one of my network and they'll say, oh, no, Michael, that's not it. Because those self-illusions will get me in trouble. Even the bad ones. You know, me thinking bad about something. Usually it's the Father's thing that's really reality. I'll say this in close. You know, I don't know. Really, I don't know. Things that I thought was good, not. I thought my alcoholism was the worst thing that ever happened to me. It turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me. I've had a number of women in my life that I thought it was the best thing that ever happened to me that turned out to be one of the worst. So I don't really know what's good or bad for me. I know that I have to remain teachable. And when I remain teachable, the teacher appears. This hasn't been an easy way of living, but it sure in hell been a better way. Thank you.